annual Bronx Professor of Canadian Studies at the University of Ottawa on this very subject. Professor Parr is in our Ottawa studio this morning. Hi.
Hi.
Let's start, if we can, with one of the items I know you talked about in your speech last night, this K-42 General Electric tea kettle.
Yes.
What is the significance of a tea kettle?
Oh, well, one of those tea kettles was in almost 90% of Canadian homes after the war. So it's an object that people all knew about. It was made out of the mold for a car headlight, and it was made out of a car for a whole car headlight during the Second World War, because there was an injunction that no new household product design should be worked up during the war.
Okay, I need a picture of this, Joy. What exactly did the kettle look like? In the 1950s, I had trouble looking over the kitchen counter.
Well, think about a Model T, and think about the headlight of a Model T mounted outside the body of the car. That was the mold to make the kettle. So it was a high, round kettle with a resin, black resin handle on the top. Place cut out of the headlight mold for a spout. And then it was clad in nickel chrome, to the same quality of nickel chrome as if it had been used as a headlight outside of a car. So it was a real shiny, round, wonderfully round nickel thing.
And it was in 90% of our homes because there wasn't anything else to choose from, or because people at the time really liked the kettle?
During the war, there wasn't anything else to choose from. And after the war, people really liked the kettle. The aesthetics after the war were very geometric. Think of what high modernism told people was beautiful. But this was beautiful because it shone so wonderfully. I mean, there was your whole kitchen reflected back to you in this shiny kettle, which kept shining up. The one that I took last night to the auditorium was, you know, making the telly lights glint all over. You can even now, you know, check your lipstick in it. There's no doubt. Well, you could if you wanted.
I won't, but
okay.
but as a cultural historian, when you choose an item like this, is it to get a sense of what choices we had as consumers, or are you looking at it more from the point of view of the people who produced goods for us?
Both. I started with that problem because it was both and then some more. I want to know what the constraints technologically are for producers making these things, what they think they can do in the market, what the problems are in profitability for them. So I look at the internal records of the firms. Then I talk to the designers about what their goals were and what their constraints were. And then I've talked to a large number of women who married between 1945 and 65 and were willing to just tell me what they bought, one thing after another. So the kettle's a neat example because the production constraints are quite clearly monitored in the material controllers files of the Wartime Prices Board, and then you get another set of sort of whining, whinging, what are we going to do around General Electric as they try to figure out how to manage the controllers' very strict limitations on what they can do. And then you have lots of women who talk about why they liked the thing, why they used it. But in that case, there's also this other thing that matters, which is that it's an example of an exception to a rule that said that Canadian firms were to design new household goods during the war. Then after the war, there are another set of rules put into place within the framework of Keynesian macroeconomic policy plans for how to build a better economy, which involved putting all the resources that Canada had after the war into making producer rather than consumer goods. So the firms that made appliances in particular, goods that needed metals, from 39 until... new product design. And by the time they started doing a lot of product design in 1950, the American branch plants in this country were 10 years ahead of them. And I think there, the kettle is an example of an exception to a rule that I think was pretty key to doing in the Canadian appliance industry as an independent Canadian industry that could have responded to consumers. And when we said, we want a tea kettle, we don't care whether the Americans don't drink tea, we want a tea kettle, could have responded well. Instead, we're dealing with domestic goods manufacturers now who are making for global markets and don't care if every single woman in British Columbia wants something different from what they're making.
Were we, as post-war Canadian consumers, though, enough of a market force to matter to the manufacturers or the designers, or were we doomed to consume what the Americans were going to make because of the size of their market?
In the post-war period, up until the early 60s, I don't think we were thus doomed. At that point, much batch production continued, that is short series production, in the domestic appliance field and certainly in furniture. I mean, furniture until very lately has just been a series of artisanal workshops hived together in a single building. So for lots and lots of household goods, the market was big enough. One exception was refrigerators. Unless we'd done a whole lot of contracting out of refrigerator parts, it would have been hard to build a plant in this country that could have economically produced refrigerators.
Can we talk about something else you've written at some length about, and that is the design of the oven, because this one puzzles me a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You talk about an oven design that predates the war, which was at waist level. You can take what you want out of the oven without bending over.
Mm-hmm.
And then it
mass produce these things. You want them all to be white boxes because you want to just run the same line season after season. One season we'll make white boxes called fridges. The next season we'll make white boxes called automatic washing machines. So getting it into a single case that then could be readily reconverted into the next case was the mass production thing to do. And even though in Canada and in Sweden and in lots of European countries, mass production of domestic appliances was not yet on the scene and wouldn't be on the scene for some time, the aesthetics of modern was defined in Detroit by the mass production assembly line.
But weren't the designers, whether or not they're in the United States or Canada, talking to the people who were using the product? In this case, I guess we're talking about largely women who would be using the oven.
Seems not. When they did, I mean, Henry Dreyfuss is wonderfully revealing about this, a very eminent and interesting and good American designer of the period. His view was that women just really didn't know about labor processes. And if they had a high oven, to take the point we're talking about now, he said they'd keep peeking in there. So he thought he knew better.
Keep it down low so people don't look in the oven?
No. Oh, sorry. When people talk with him about why we should have a high oven, one
right,
that would be at waist level, he said that wouldn't be a good idea because you wouldn't have constant temperature because the lady would keep peeking in.
I got you.
So the interwar ovens had the stoves had a high oven. The post-war ones are like the ones we have now, unless you're lucky enough to have a built-in wall oven in your house. And people want built-in wall ovens because they want a higher oven. So the protest that Canadian consumers offered at the time, and they did it every time they were asked, and they were asked more frequently then, was that you had to bend down with a lot of heavy weights at a time when you were doing a lot of baking, you were doing meal preparations for a big crowd. But it was interesting, actually, the men said they knew the processes better, but all of the ads to sell those stoves in the post-war period have a woman bending over with one of those crinoline new look dresses on,
right,
and a man looking at her bum. So I don't know. There's sort of, I'm sure that's not the driving design force, but it says something about whose concerns are being considered.
But we're also talking about an industry or any industry which at that time was controlled by men, wasn't it?
Yep.
There is another exception that you write about. I like this one. This is the wringer washer, and it's an exception because it sets Canadian consumers apart from the Americans.
Yes.
Am I right about that?
So,
how did it happen?
Well, wringers have been made here, well, as they've been made in the United States for a long time. Wringers are a good machine to make in a foundry, to make in short series. They're not actually readily adapted to mass production. So Canadians were doing them very well. There were lots of manufacturers here who knew how to make pumps, and so they knew how to make wringer washers. They also don't require a lot of water or water under steady pressure. The women I talked with for this book were mostly in British Columbia, and they talked about being able to take a wringer on a houseboat or up the coast when they were, you know, living on a scow as they were moving from logging camp to logging camp. And to this day, you see them in cottages in places where there's not a regular supply of water. You have to conserve water. The other thing is they were easier on clothes. I mean, you had a lot of control over them. So if you're putting handmade clothes in them, you could sit and watch and know they were better substituted for hand washing of things. You had a lot of control over them.
But in the 50s, if I'm right, mm-hmm. Canadian women were embracing their wringer washers at a time when American women were stampeding off towards the automatic ones, right?
That's true, yes. In the United States, some automatic washers went on the market in 1950, and they swept the market. People didn't buy wringers anymore. They weren't manufactured anymore. If you wanted a wringer washer in the United States, you had to import one from Canada. In Canada, right until 1965, each year, more wringers than automatics are sold. And even the wealthiest Canadians, if you control that by income group, are still buying wringers in preference to automatics because of how much water they use, the lack of control over the process, the lack of flexibility in the machine if you move from one place to another, and the amount of water was... a political issue. Remember, the post-war period is a time in Canada where we're establishing conservation authorities. We're worried about how to manage water. There are water shortages all across the country in the summer. And a lot of women just weren't willing to buy into the notion of a machine that used that much water, that was as frail as the early automatics were. The Maytag man was designed to refute a claim that was justifiably made against the early automatics, that they were frail machines, that they often broke down. And there him sitting with his hat. I mean, your uncle or your dad could repair your wringer. Maybe you could repair it yourself. Right. But you'd have to call in the Maytag man to Walkerton, Ontario, or wherever, to get your automatic washer repaired. They were frail machines, whereas the wringers were built to last. You can find 1930s wringers on the decks of houseboats on the Fraser River to this day.
Joy, tell me something. As a cultural historian, what comes first? Do you pick a time, the post-war period, and then examine the articles to learn what was going on, or could you actually just go back into one of those times, pick an article, and use that as a guide to what was going on?
I don't think it would speak for itself, because if we think of the wringer washer, and say, think of a Canadian woman in 55 and an American woman in 55, those two women would sit in front of the washer and give you a very different story about what that machine was about. Even if you had an engineer looking at the same thing at the same time, an American engineer would probably look at the machine and say, this is overbuilt. And a Canadian engineer would look at the machine and say, this is built just right. So you'd need a lot of cultural context to construe the things. There are some objects, for example, this colonial maple furniture that was available in both Canada and the United States after the war, that stuff that sort of ruby red, has a finish on it like nail polish.
I slept in a bed like that, I'm
oh,
sure.
Oh, you too, yes. Fewer girls than boys. Almost every Canadian boy has got experience of being in one of those bunk beds.
It's really hard to carve stuff in that, you know?
I know. Well, they worked very hard in Stratford, Ontario, and in Sherbrooke, Quebec, at the Vilas plant, of being sure that you couldn't carve stuff into it.
Yeah.
And people who try to refinish them just give up in despair. You can't get all that varnish off. But Canadians and Americans both use those kinds of maple, ersatz maple furniture after the war, but they have quite different readings of what it means. In the United States, it's part of a pilgrim colonial tradition. In Canada, it was small-scale stuff that wasn't particularly visually commanding that would fit into a small CMHC bungalow. It was part of a plan to try to build a better world by living more modestly.
You're telling me I was part of a larger scheme by sleeping in that bed?
You were part of a political decision your mom and dad made when they bought that bed.
Tell me, Joy, when you look at goods that we handle and touch today, does your brain turn to, gee, I wonder what that's going to say about us?
I think I'm a bit more present-minded. I look at what's around today with present concerns, and I suppose since I've been doing this book in the last few years, have been reading through the minds of these depression mentality, as they describe themselves, women with whom I spoke. I worry about how much waste is building up around us. I worry about the fact that I seem to be buying a new computer every 3 years for some reason that I'm not quite clear on,
right.
So that I've got a stack of them like doorstops in the back of my closet, because I can't quite imagine if I paid $3,000 for it and it was only a year ago that I shouldn't somehow keep it. But
you could lie them on their back and take the screen out and plant things in them, maybe.
You think that? Have you tried it?
No. No, he confesses. The book that you've written, Domestic Goods, The Material, The Moral, and The Economic in the Post-War Years, is it? I gather it's not going to be published till next year.
August.
Are you trying to direct us in the way that we consume with that by going back and looking at the way that we were forced to consume or told to consume?
Yes, I suppose I am. Well, I'm asking that I hope that when people read the book, it'll be make them more self-conscious about the relationship between the direction we get from the state about how and what to buy, the direction we get from producers, or the way that producers think and designers think. I hope it'll have some influence on producers and designers in thinking about what they use and why they make it. And it seems to me that this is a story that says that just by not buying, you can have quite a lot of influence, and that well-considered ethical purchasing does matter, does set examples, and that we need to be demanding as users and think of ourselves as users rather than consumers.
It's an interesting thought. Thanks for coming in to chat with us.
You're most welcome.
Professor Joy Pars, an economist and a cultural historian at Simon Fraser University. She was in our Ottawa studio this morning. Now here's a song.